In her reports to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, she has written on violence in the family, violence in the community, violence against women during armed conflict, and problem of international trafficking. A strong voice and an advocate on women's rights, she has intervened on behalf of countless women throughout the world seeking clarification from governments in cases involving violence against women. Ms. Kumaraswamy was appointed chairperson of Sri Lanka Human Rights Commission in May of 2003. She was also a director of the International Study for International Center for Ethnic Study in Sri Lanka, leading research projects in the field of women and human rights. She has served as a member of the global faculty of the University of New York School of Law. She has published widely, including two books on constitutional law and numerous articles on ethnic studies and status of women. Ms. Kumaraswamy is a graduate of the United Nations and International School in New York. She received her BA from Yale University, her JD from Columbia University, an LLM from Harvard University, and honorary PhDs from Amherst College, the University of Edinburgh, and the University of Essex. It is with a great honor that I present Undersecretary General, Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict, Ms. Kumaraswamy.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and I want to thank the United Nations Association for having invited me here, and also the mayor of Kansas City for hosting the dinner tonight. Let me begin by telling you who I am, and therefore, so that you would know, at least in my official capacity, why I'm speaking to you tonight. I am the Secretary General's Special Representative on Children in Armed Conflict, and in that sense, I am supposed to be an independent moral voice for issues relating to children in armed conflict. In a previous incarnation, I was the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women for the Human Rights Commission, and that's why I did so much work on women. But since 2006, my mandate has been children. And the United Nations in 1996 was really concerned by the way recent wars were being fought, especially in Africa. And they appointed Graca Machel, who is the wife of Nelson Mandela, to do a study on the situation of children and armed conflict. And she completed that study. And everybody was so horrified by the findings of that study that they created a post at the level of Undersecretary General, which is the highest post next to, in the sense of the hierarchy of the bureaucracy of the UN, purely to fight for the issue of children in armed conflict. So that was the commitment of the United Nations on this issue. Michelle's report shows how children during armed conflict are affected in many ways. Either they are often killed or maimed as a result of conflict, direct violence. They become IDPs and especially vulnerable to abuse in IDP camps. There are orphans and child-headed families throughout the conflict zones. They are often trafficked for sexual violence, and often, of course, they are recruited as armed cadres in different armed forces around the world. Today, what I thought I would talk to you about is about the problem of child soldiers in particular, and also just mention something about what we see as the changing nature of warfare around the world. Let me begin with the story of Abu, a young boy from Sierra Leone who I met in Cote d'Ivoire. He was young and in school in Sierra Leone when the rebels, the RUF, invaded his village. He was abducted and taken to the RUF camp, where he was trained and into a soldier. And he described how they were often injected with drugs, given guns, and made to raid the very villages that he had actually been living in and to do heinous things in those villages. Abu was, at the end of the war, was taken into a reintegration program. In the old days, he was given 6 months training, and he trained as a mechanic. And then he went back home, and then he disappeared. His mother could not really come to terms with disciplining him or having him in the family, and he found it difficult. And we found him again in Cote d'Ivoire when the forces were being, child soldiers were being rehabilitated there. He emerged as a child soldier in Cote d'Ivoire. He had been re-recruited and crossed the border to Cote d'Ivoire and fought the war there. So I think one of the things we have to realize is this issue of child soldiers is something the UN has to do something about, and the international community. Now, the Security Council has been very much engaged with this issue as well, strangely. Security Council usually does not get involved in these kinds of issues, but on children and armed conflict, it has become involved. And it has set up a monitoring and reporting mechanism to report to the Council on what are called the six grave violations against children. The six grave violations are the killing and maiming of children, sexual violence against children, abduction of children, recruitment and use of child soldiers, denial of humanitarian access, and attacks on schools and hospitals. So around the world, the UN has set up monitoring and reporting mechanisms in the conflict areas to report to the Council on these grave violations. Of these, until recently, the only one in which the Council was thinking of using sanctions and other punitive measures was the one on child soldiers. Every year, we prepare a list for the Council on the parties that recruit and use child soldiers. We name them and list them. The possibility of targeted measures against these parties exists. And we use this list to go around the world and negotiate with non-state actors to say, if you enter into an action plan with the United Nations and release your children, you will go get off this list, and there will not be any measures taken against you. So how recently, over the course of the last year, having this list of shame and threatening sanctions has worked. As I said in the morning program, have gone into the Central African Republic, met with the APRD in the African bush, and they have agreed. They have released 400 children. We went to the Philippines, into Mindanao, where the MILF operate and talk to the non-state actors. Initially, they told us, under Muslim law, a child is only what is under 12. And then we explained all the international conventions. And in the end, the MILF came along and agreed to release their children. And in June, finalized an action plan, and children are being now released into the hands of UNICEF. This has happened in Burundi, in Cote d'Ivoire, in Sri Lanka, and also in Nepal, where children are being released, mainly because of the Security Council action. But to some extent, the challenges still remain. The persistent violations there are still 19 persistent violators who continue to use children. We want to move forward in this regard and try and get targeted measures and some kind of action against these parties. Some, of course, are persistent violators who just don't care. I don't think Al-Qaeda cares or the FARC in Colombia care with what the international community say. Though strangely, the Taliban in their rules of conduct have a rule that says you shall not take boys without facial hair either into combat or into your apartment or your quarters. So they recognize the child soldiers, but not Al-Qaeda or Al-Shahab or FARC or many others. They don't care what the international community says. But there are a large number of parties that really do care what the international community says. And it is that group that we have targeted now and are targeting to go to them to say that if you release your children, you will not be listed on the Secretary General's list of shame. There will not be sanctions used against you. The other issue that comes up to us, we always say that there are three pillars in dealing with the issue of child soldiers. The first is prevention, the second is deterrence, and the third is reintegration. The issue of prevention, as you know, is to deal with prevention, you have to understand the root causes of conflict. For a long time, we always thought that children were child soldiers mainly because they were abducted in situations of war, but we're finding more and more that children actually join armed groups. We won't say voluntarily, because what does that mean, but they do actually offer themselves. And that is due sometimes to poverty in the areas that they live. There is no other vocation. Sometimes an armed group is the only way you can get 3 square meals a day. They do it because of discrimination or because their community has a sense of being humiliated. So they have this notion, or romantic notion, of dying for a cause or for some something that will give them martyrdom. And sometimes they join because of violence in the home. Many children we found were there because mother died, father took a stepmother. They didn't like the stepmother, they preferred to join the armed groups. So these kinds of personal things also are the root causes. To do this, only recently the UN has begun to have some kind of programs, if they have access to, not everywhere do we have access, but where we have access, to try and raise awareness among the local population about the problems of child soldiers and what children face, to build capacity at the local level, to resist the recruitment of children, to negotiate with all parties to conflict, to have schools as zones of peace where we will not have, where children can come and both sides agree that they will not attack these schools, and also to ensure that schools are an important part, are kept functioning as much as possible, because they are the place where children can escape some of the terrible things of war. With regard to deterrence, as I was saying, on the one hand, prevention, root causes, and dealing with that. The second is that anyway, even if children want to join, a decision is made by a commander or a leader to recruit that child. So what we want to do is create a situation of deterrence for that decision, to punish perpetrators for what we think are terribly grave violations against children. So in this regard also, there have been some important developments. The International Criminal Court, the first action that it took, first case that it took, was the case against Thomas Lubanga, who, as you know, was indicted for recruiting and using children as child soldiers. The case is continuing. Our office filed an amicus curiae to ensure that girls are not left out, that girls who have been recruited and used as sex slaves, but also sometimes engaging in combat, are also covered by the notion of child soldiers for the sake of the ICC, so they also get the protection of the law. Then, as I said, the Security Council has now taken up this list of shame and the possibility of targeted measures. On countries where there exist sanctions committees, these lists are automatically now being transmitted to the sanctions committees. We have had sanctions in DRC, in Cote d'Ivoire, and others against parties that recruit and use children. So I think deterrence is very important at the international level. It is even more important at the national level, and we're trying to build capacity in these countries to make them pass laws to ensure that children under a certain age are not recruited, under 18, and that those who do recruit children will be prosecuted for war crimes or crimes against humanity. Then the third pillar when dealing with child soldiers is the issue of reintegration. This is a very difficult process. Once children have been child soldiers, how do we get them back into society? Recently I was in Nepal and went to meet the former child soldiers. I had a full half day with them. And initially they were extremely hostile. They said, "We don't want to see you, please go away. We're very happy being soldiers. We want to be soldiers in the Maoist army, and then we want to join the Nepalese army, and we don't want the United Nations." So it took some time for us to persuade them to say that this is because that's all they know in their village. They were in high school. Maoists came recruiting, and they have nothing else. And the United Nations in Nepal has formulated 64 trades, as we call them, to talk to each of these children individually and train them according to those trades, hopefully, and to take them back to their families. There's something called the Paris Principles, which talks very clearly about how children should be reintegrated and how we must work not only with the child. Often what happens is we take the child and give him some skills, but that doesn't work because sometimes they just learn the skills and get re-recruited, or they go off and join criminal gangs or political gangs. You have to work with the family. You have to give them some sense of support. Their social workers have to visit the family on a regular basis to allow the children to reintegrate with the family. You have to work with the community. You can't give special privileges to the child soldier because the child who didn't become a soldier will wonder why he's being discriminated against. So you have to work with the community, especially if it's an IDP camp, it's IDP camp, but otherwise, even if it is in the villages, to work with them, giving skills to all the children in that community. And I think to that extent, UNICEF and our partners on the ground are having an uphill battle trying to persuade donors, for example, to tell them, look, just teaching them a skill and letting them go in 6 months is not the answer. We have to have a long-term commitment. And the country itself has to have a long-term commitment toward these former child soldiers. The issue of girls also becomes extremely important. Girl combatants, on the one hand, in some societies they're abducted and made into sex slaves and lead a horrible life. In other societies, they such as in Nepal or Sri Lanka or MILF, it sometimes becomes an escape from the constraints of traditional societies, and they learn leadership skills and a certain kind of empowerment that comes by being a combatant, strangely. So the need to deal with girl children and their special needs. In Colombia, when I met girl combatants, this was about 10 years ago. Things have changed there, but they were very dispirited. They said their family doesn't like them. Wants them to become traditional housewives. They don't want to be anywhere near their family. And many of them go into sex work and live in the city and lead independent lives because they cannot really get back into society. And very few men will marry a woman whom they think has carried a gun. The issue of psychosocial support for these children also becomes extremely important. I think the Harvard University has done a study looking at children in Sierra Leone over a 10-year period. It's one of many studies, but the one that I found to be very comprehensive. And what they find is that the vast majority of children, about 80%, with proper guidance, education, and training, will emerge quite all right. But the 20%, they find, especially those who have been forced to commit terrible crimes and those who are victims of sexual violence, for example, need much more support and need guidance and specialized interventions. And this is also necessary. And in many of these societies, there are no psychiatrists, no psychologists, and the need to try and develop the capacity to deal with these issues becomes a problem. And also education. We have found more and more that that is really a key for children. It is, on the one hand, as I said, negotiating with all parties to make schools zones of peace. We are also now insisting that education becomes an important part of emergency planning. The moment UNHCR or any of them starts setting up IDP camps, at the same time they must set up schools. Because the one thing that settles children down in IDP camps, et cetera, is having that normal routine of going to school. So education as an important part of emergency planning. And of course, education is key to reintegration. We have met, as you know, created a network of former child soldiers who have done very well with their lives to be role models for other child soldiers. One of them, Grace, who was was abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army from a very elite private school in northern Uganda. They were taken away into the bush by the Lord's Resistance Army. The Italian principal of the school followed them into the bush and just wouldn't leave. But finally, Kony released 150 of the children, but another 50 stayed, and Grace was one of those who stayed. She finally escaped and ran away, and the Ugandan army took her back to her home. She went back to school, and now she's here at Clark doing postgraduate university life, and she's doing very well. Education, she said, was the key. Once she went back to school and that routine, she began to find herself. So I think to some extent we have to continue to deal with these challenges of reintegrating children, and my field partners on the ground, UNICEF and the other child protection partners such as Save the Children and others are doing yeoman's job in the field with this whole issue. We have had in this field of children in armed conflict a lot of success at the United Nations. You know, the United Nations is often looked at as a place where nothing moves, nothing. But on children in armed conflict, there have been some extraordinary things that have happened. First, to think that the Security Council, which only deals mainly with peace and security issues, took this issue up. And that is thanks to my predecessor, Mr. Olara Otunnu, who pushed it very hard and said, you know, there's no peace and security unless children are protected and children are not recruited. And as I said, they actually set up a monitoring and reporting mechanism in these countries to collect data to a working group that meets every 2 months. And as I said, they had a list of shame of parties that recruit and use children, and they have threatened sanctions against those parties. Now, in August this year, we moved a big step forward. The Security Council has now asked that we provide them with a list not only of parties that recruit and use children, but also parties that commit sexual violence, that there's a pattern of sexual violence in their conduct, military conduct, and that we should list them as well, and parties that kill and maim with impunity, that we should list them as well. So this is a big step forward. We will be able to list many parties who do grave violations against children. And hopefully they will move the extra step to have some kind of measures against those parties. Then in September of this year too, they passed Resolution 1888, which now is trying to set up a similar system as they have set up for children in armed conflict for sexual violence against women and girls in wartime, and to have action taken by the Council. So these are certain recent developments in the Council that the Security Council often is seen as being deadlocked on other issues, but on this issue, they really do seem quite united. So we are happy about that, and we hope to use that consensus to move forward. What is really holding them up is this, not all of them are on board to go full hog with regard to the sanctions using measures against parties that commit grave violations. Finally, what are the challenges we have ahead? Well, the immediate challenges is that in addition to the three that I just mentioned in which we are listing parties, we feel that attacks on schools should be taken very seriously. We have this new phenomenon around the world, in Thailand, in Afghanistan, of schools being attacked, especially girls' schools. And this, we feel, is a new development. UNESCO is being also very concerned about this, and how we handle that issue is a challenge. The second is that children are increasingly in IDP camps and in IDP centers being denied humanitarian access as the wars become more vicious, and we feel there are all kinds of bureaucratic hurdles being put forward, the hostilities themselves, and also the killing of humanitarian workers, as you know, just recently, even in Pakistan, is making it difficult for us to give humanitarian support to children. And this is something that also concerns us gravely. But in the long term, I think what we're all quite worried is the changing nature of warfare. As you know, traditional wars or wars between combatants and the civilian population was just accidentally or something involved. We're finding that now civilians are actually becoming central targets, in fact, of warfare, including children. This, where one kind of warfare, for example, the internal wars in Africa and Asia, which involve ethnic cleansing and all kinds of things related to tribal, ethnic, and other conflicts, where the civilians are the targets, where there's rape, where there's recruitment of children, and just large-scale bloodletting. As you know, traditional war, rules of war, had two principles that were crucial. One is that you always distinguish between combatants and civilians, and that what they call the rule of distinction. And the second is the rule of proportionality, that any use of force will be proportional to the threat. But these, as I said, internal wars where they're engaging in ethnic and tribal conflict pose issues. Then we're having wars in which there's a blurring of lines between criminal gangs and political gangs. And one minute they're doing criminal activities, next minute they're doing political activities, and this criminalization of warfare is also posing a lot. And just criminal gangs themselves act in many ways like armed groups in warfare, as the ones, if you see City of God, any of those movies in Latin America, you see increasingly younger and younger children involved in that kind of violence. And finally, in the whole issue of fighting terrorism, we're finding major problems, especially with regard to children in armed conflict. We're finding child suicide bombers. The the Pakistani bomb that killed 40 children, I think, in Islamabad was a 13-year-old child suicide bomber. And so we are finding increasingly children being used in this way. As I mentioned earlier, there are attacks on schools, girl children, teachers, principals, acid throwing at girl children and principals. These are concerns. And of course, some of the terrorist methodology is to use civilian areas as targets. But also in fighting terrorism, we have issues, which is that because children are being more and more involved, we have lots of children in detention. And how do we deal with that whole issue? Children also victims of what is termed euphemistically called collateral damage. We have all those kinds of issues. So that is for this reason that the United Nations has now taken a major step forward, along with, I noticed, General McChrystal in Afghanistan, to make protection of civilians a core part of its work in peacekeeping. And realizing that the United Nations may have to take offensive military operations in some parts of the world and not only be an umpire between combatants. And in this regard, on children, we have managed to work out a process. We now have, in all the military missions that the UN peacekeepers have around the world, what we call child protection advisors. These child protection advisors are there to train the military first on how to deal with children. Their children are often hanging around the camps because they're infatuated with military men, to make sure that they're not used in quarters to cook and clean, first at that level. Secondly, to do what to do when you come across children, when you're fighting them. What do you do if children are shooting at you? All this kind of training is done by child protection advisors. Then these advisors also engage in advocacy and protection issues with regard to this issue in that country. They're also the key points in monitoring and reporting on the grave violations against children, along with UNICEF, monitoring and reporting to the Security Council on the grave violations against children. They're the interface with child protection actors. For example, as the peacekeepers in Congo, when they go into an area and they see child soldiers, they immediately call up the child protection advisor. He comes, he talks to the children, takes them over to UNICEF, and the rehabilitation process begins. And he himself, in some cases, negotiates with non-state actors, such as in the Sudan and other places, to release children and to enter into action plans with the United Nations. So the protection of civilians then now becoming a key part of UN peacekeeping and becoming centerpiece in its approach to peacekeeping, especially in Africa. So let me conclude with that. Just children have an uncanny way of telling the truth. I remember this young boy in Burundi at a reintegration center cuddled up to me, and he looked and he said, "Madam, you've now spoken so much, so what are you really going to do?" he said. So I had no answer. I said, "Well, we'll try." But meeting them only doubles our need to really work hard to ensure that, as I said, the three pillars: to prevent recruitment, to deter and punish those who recruit children, and to ensure that the victims themselves are reintegrated so that they can lead full and meaningful lives. Thank you.
You mentioned IDP camps and the problems of children and women and civilians in IDP camps. Last, I believe it was May, in Sri Lanka, there was the final offensive against the Tamils, which the Sri Lankan government won, and there was widespread criticism that the Sri Lankan government had simply interned huge numbers of Tamil civilians, including women and children, and were keeping them there, were not letting independent monitors, including the United Nations, in to monitor, and the basic purpose of the Sri Lankan government was to contain them as all potential having been collaborators. What's your take on the United Nations' response to that criticism, that it basically just said, it said nothing to the Sri Lankan government in the face of the Sri Lankan government saying, "This is for us to take care of our internment camps, United Nations, go away"?
Well, in the sense, Sri Lankan government is particularly difficult, as we know, on these issues. But I don't think the UN said we won't do anything. What the present situation with regard to the UN approach to the Sri Lankan government is, first, we want you to have a process with regard to the accountability for what took place those 2 weeks in May. As you know, Nabi Pillay, who is the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, has been pushing for a probe into what took place in those 2 weeks. So that's, and the Secretary General, when he went to Sri Lanka, got Sri Lanka to agree to that probe. The issue is that the international community has said, "Well, we'll first see what you do nationally." Whether they will do anything is another question, but that is the first step. But if that doesn't work, then of course, perhaps an international query. So it's not that they're off the hook. And as you know, the US State Department report recently also on grave violations in those 2 weeks. So the first issue is accountability for those 2 weeks. Then comes the issue of children in the internment camps. And these camps, we have objected to all the time. We have said that they're mainly because of no freedom of movement. The conditions in the camps are actually all right, and that's mainly because the UN is providing them with food and shelter and all the other things. I mean, it's very much like an IDP camp anywhere in the world, but that's not the issue. The issue is they should be allowed the freedom of movement and not be allowed to be contained like that. And I think at every UN visit it is said. Walter Kaelin was there, special representative on IDPs recently. He also stressed that point, you know. And every visit, everything, we keep stressing that point. I myself, being Sri Lankan, cannot go there, so I have appointed a Major General Khmer, who is a peacekeeper, to go on my behalf. He is now going to travel there on December 6th, and he will look particularly at, first, the issue of children in the IDP camps, and their needs and concerns. Secondly, of how former child combatants are being reintegrated and rehabilitated, and whether they can be reunited with their families and return to a life of normalcy. And thirdly, also, so those two issues will be looked up by him. And I think the UN has been consistently engaged with Sri Lanka. We've been criticized from both sides. The Tamil extremists, of course, say that we haven't said enough, and sometimes it seems like that. But the single extremists also feel that we are interfering too much, always, you know, poking and. But I think the UN has a responsibility to protect these people, and we will do as much as we can using the tools that we have. You know, the Security Council is not engaged on this issue, so we can't send peacekeepers. So we have to rely on the UNHCR, UNICEF, and the traditional agencies. And they, of course, work in a different way than a peacekeeping mission, which comes and imposes its will. The refugees and the UNICEF work slowly, quietly, and behind the scenes, usually. But the situation is in Sri Lanka is something we have spoken about, and the Secretary General has also spoken about. I think he calls the president every other week, if I'm not mistaken. They have released 40,000 just last week. But there's a belief that then they're put into some smaller camps in the other areas, you know. So we had to watch the situation carefully.
Good day, ma'am. I have actually two questions. One is if you could give us some examples of the proposed sanctions against some of these groups. And the second question would be, what is the current status of the programs to help former child soldiers in Sierra Leone?
Okay. The first question with regard to sanctions, of course, are travel bans, assets freezing, travel bans, and I think arms embargoes, etc. Now, you may say some of them really don't care. But some do, many do, because many of these see themselves as alternative leaders in their countries, they are affected by such things. And also people who are supplying those things are also, such as diamond traders and all, become affected once the sanctions are in place. Secondly, with regard to Sierra Leone, as you know, Sierra Leone, to some extent, is a UN success story in the sense that there is now a stable government. There are many programs for these children. But, you know, the scale of the violence, the scale of the suffering was so extensive that they would never really be enough, what we do or what we have in that sense. So I think one could argue that there's still a lot more to be done. But at least the process of healing has begun. They have, first with regard to justice issues, They have a court that they have set up, which is beginning to deal with the leaders. Then, with regard to children and child combatants, there is the truth and reconciliation system, because the decision was not to prosecute anybody under the age of 18. So many of these were child soldiers who committed terrible crimes. So that through the truth and reconciliation process, they're trying to deal with the children in that way. And also at the community level to have programs to have the child come back. Like, for example, in some of the communities, they make the children who were former child soldiers do something for the village, like build a wall or build a road or whatever, do community service as payback, and so that they can be accepted back into the community. So there are various experiments like that also going. But most important is that it's a stable society at the moment. There doesn't seem to be really any recurrence of this violence. And so it's really important that we put all our efforts to rebuild it so that it can. It's having very high growth rates, but as someone said, it began with nothing. So in that sense, it can be.
How are you determining who's prosecuted with the ICC and who's...
Sorry?
How are you determining... Which who's groups? Going to be prosecuted by the International okay. Criminal Courts, and who's forgiven by Truth and Reconciliation, aside from the children?
Okay. Well, let me just say, the ICC, as you know, the main problem with ICC is that first you have to be a member to some extent. If you sign, then any of the crimes that took place in your country can be prosecuted. Or the Security Council can send a case to the ICC. Or the country where the incident occurred or the defendant is can give permission. So those are the three jurisdictional. So what has happened, interestingly, is that many African countries have signed on to the ICC, so including the Congo. So what happened with the government of Congo signing on to the ICC is that all the war crimes taken that have took place in the Congo now become the province of the ICC. The ICC has teams running all over, especially the eastern Congo, trying to prosecute people. So the prosecutorial discretion rests with, of course, the prosecutor, and he is going for those in which he has collected evidence and where he can bring that evidence to bear. Now you have to take these people to testify, and you know there's a whole decision that has to be made there. So he has in the case now of Lubanga, then of Bemba, there are quite a few, I think there are six that he's prosecuting. As you know, one of the most controversial is the ICC indicting the president of Sudan. That is because the Security Council asked the ICC to prosecute those who were responsible for war crimes in Darfur, and the ICC, in that sense, I think four names were given, one of them the president of Sudan. And that has raised all hosts of issues. Should we, when we go to Sudan, be seen near him, or this and that? But anyway, so that was the others. The truth and reconciliation processes in Sierra Leone, the notion was for those who bear the greatest responsibility, you have a trial. For those who, so those are basically the leaders, and for the rest you have truth and reconciliation. So that is the strategy that is followed by the prosecutors in Sierra Leone. Yes, the ICC requires that you exhaust domestic, all international courts require that you exhaust domestic remedies. So if the domestic remedies in that sense are there, the ICC does not act. Congo called on the ICC to do it because they felt that they did not have the structure to do it. Abdul, question?
Yes, how does the ICC and CIDO, for example, help the organizations that are protecting women and children, for example, UNHCR and UNICEF, how does that and ratification of United States, ratifying that, will be able to help those organizations be implementing those protection that they give to the children
Which
and women?
ICC and CEDAW?
Yes.
Well, I think,
if you know, United States signs, the only two countries that did not sign is Somalia and the United States.
This is the CRC, you mean?
Yeah.
The Convention on the Rights of the Child you're talking about.
Yes.
The Convention on the Rights of the Child, yes, only the United States and Somalia have not signed. Interestingly, the United States signed the optional protocol on the recruitment and use of child soldiers. They've signed that. So the child soldiers, but not the main... I think basically for us, having the United States on board and leading on many of these issues is very key for our work, because I think having the backing of the United States in these conflict zones is very important, because the United States is an important influential actor in every of these places. So if the United States signs these documents, then of course it gives its certain moral authority that is both to the United States and to the United Nations. So I think it's really important that the United States, as a leader in the global community, sign these documents.
I'd like to thank you for coming to Kansas City. As a husband, father, grandfather, and a great-grandfather of both male and female children, I'd like to point out that all combatants are children. Mm-hmm. All combatants are somebody's child, grandchild, daughter, etc. And as one who's beginning to, on the sunset side of my life a little bit, it confuses me a little bit with the United Nations as a United States citizen that the world community does not seem to really embrace the idea as firmly as it needs to for it to really work. We have these power plays on the Permanent Security Council for whatever the reason might be from one decade to another. And we talk about sanctions, and my perception is that the United Nations doesn't have much clout. The gentleman mentioned a while ago that the United States doesn't want to sign the ICC agreements because we don't want people coming here telling us how to run our business. But we don't hesitate to go other places in the world and tell them how to run their business. And there needs to be a more in-depth, ongoing discussion about some of these issues. And these probably are beyond your realm of responsibility, but maybe it's water cooler discussion for you a little bit, but we appreciate your coming.
No, thank you. No, it's in the realm as Undersecretary General of the United Nations, being in the Secretary General's so-called cabinet, of course it's our responsibility. But let me first begin with the question you raised about everybody's, somebody's child. I think what we feel, to some extent by saying under 18, many of my social scientist friends say, look, childhood is a construction. What is this 18 arbitrary date? You know, in one country, people grow up, it's 12, other times 14, et cetera. But we do believe there is some scientific basis to the fact that in terms of moral reasoning and other issues, children do not become adults until about 18. And this is very important for child soldiers because children do not have that notion of death that adults have. They don't take precautions. This is absolutely verified on the battlefield. Do not take precautions to protect themselves the way adults will. They will go straight into the line of fire without second thought, and that's why people like them as soldiers. So I think there is a reason for that date of 18 and why we need to protect children under that age, and that's why I think that it has been, or at least definitely under 16 or 15, because they think it's a game, they go straight into the line of fire. So that's the first one. Second, with regard to the United Nations, you know, the United Nations is primarily an idea. I mean, at its base, it's an idea that we will resolve our conflicts and our issues globally through dialogue and discussion. And so whatever we may feel about what the United Nations is doing now, we can't be against that idea. You know, there has to be an institution that gives us a forum to have these discussions, to have these dialogues. So I think that in that sense, it's just justified to exist. I think there's no question about it. The question is then, how is it doing it? Is it doing it well? What are the measures we can take to reform it? I think that is the conversation we should have, not United Nations or no United Nations, United States, get out of the United Nations. You can't only just talk to like-minded people. You have to talk to unlike-minded people if you want world peace. So the United Nations, in that sense, is crucial. But I think it does have, it may not have that much clout in the United States, for example, because it's a powerful country, but the United Nations has a lot of clout in Africa, you know, basically in the DRC. It has a lot of clout, and it can. It's what it says and does matter in those countries much more than, say, perhaps in the United States. So I think in different parts of the world, there is a different sense of clout. But in the end, I think the United States needs the United Nations to deal with the world. I don't think it can, to some extent, be using its armed forces. With the situation in Congo, can you send the Marines there? Can you send, you can't deal with the whole world. You need an institution that will deal with the trouble spots of the world for you as well as for everybody else. And you need an international institution that will fund development projects and allow people to, you can't take that responsibility all yourself, even though you are the global. So you need the United Nations for the rest of the world. And it's always, and when the United States leads, the United Nations really thrives. Now in my field in human rights, it was Eleanor Roosevelt who was behind the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and who was behind the setting up the whole human rights structure of the United Nations, which has now been raised as a third pillar of the United Nations. Secondly, it was during the time of Ralph Bunche and all these people in the United Nations that the United Nations Human Rights Commission began to set up special mechanisms to go out into the countries and report on situations of violence during Ralph Bunche's time, during Jimmy Carter's time. So when the United States, in the field of human rights and others, leads, the UN also thrives. And I think it's very important to have a good relation. When we don't have a good relationship, I think world peace really does suffer.
Ms. Kumaraswamy, I guess we would all agree that undoubtedly a group of any kind that would force a child to become a soldier is probably reprehensible in its ideology. You spoke briefly about the wars or engagements of the future, and it seems like our future, what we have to look forward to, are engagements of the religious, ethnic kind. Is it possible for an organization like the UN that, you know, and I do believe in the idea of the UN, certainly we can accomplish more things coming to a table than we can over a battlefield, but is it possible for a secular organization like the UN to be correctly and vocally critical of religious ideologies of all stripes that value death or the salvation possible in death more than they do living and life? It doesn't seem like we would be able to hold even these small rebel groups accountable if we were not directly critical of the religious ideologies or the political ideologies that are helping them to justify victimizing these children.
Well, I think to some extent it's true that some of the new challenges are coming from groups that claim to have religion as their motivation. These challenges are being posed. At the same time, the UN is a secular organization, but it believes a lot. It has started a big movement called the Dialogue Among Civilizations, where the basic attempt is to try and take religious main religious figures from all around the world, and to try and come up with a common humanity. So that, in fact, in all these religions, there is a common humanity, and to articulate that common humanity and to strengthen it within each of these religions. That, I think, is going on. Now, you do have extremist forces, especially in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and I think in all our religions, even Buddhism in my own country, there are extreme forces that are anti-global. In Islam, they have become more violent, perhaps, but to some extent, I think there is that tendency. And one way we may have to deal militarily with some of the attacks, there's no doubt about it. The other way is to just strengthen that middle, to ensure that we have that common humanity and that we respect each other's common humanity and bring everybody into respecting those global values. So I think that's what we'd like to do. Maybe we will have to support a military response to those who want to destroy the global order, but at the same time, we want to ensure that we keep expanding the waves of those who will join an inclusive world order. So we have to do both at the same time. The United Nations is there in Afghanistan. As you know, a lot of our people were killed recently. Many, we have we are there providing humanitarian service. But I think we have to play it both ways.
Relative to your comments prior to this question about the behavior of the United States in the United Nations, is it too premature to judge the way the Obama administration has approached the role of the United States in the United Nations compared to, say, the preceding administration?
You're really putting me on the hot spot. Let me just say that even the previous administration had certain priorities that were quite helpful. And on children and armed conflict, sexual violence and others, they were quite strong. So there were some strong points. But there's no doubt that the United Nations welcomes the fact that the administration, the present administration, sees the UN as a partner, not something that needs to be pushed aside or is not so important. So I think we welcome that. And I hope we'll be able to rise to the occasion. That's very important, that we reform ourselves and make sure that we can rise to the occasion. And I think hopefully we will. And I think that is what we welcome, is the acknowledgement of us as a partner.
Yes, good afternoon, good evening. In the United States, we don't really have child soldiers, but we do have violent street gangs. Recently, we've had some high-profile things in the news, killings in Chicago, some other violence in California. Since the United States has no prevention, no deterrence programs, no reintegration programs, can you give us some advice as to what we can do with our own violence in our own country?
Well, you know, this whole issue of criminal gangs has become a big, big concern for not only the United States, everywhere. In Latin America, I mean, the Olympics are going to be in Rio. That is, my goodness, you know. And if you remember the City of God, the final people who take over are all under 10, all under 15, all children who take over the favela. So I think the criminal gangs is an issue. I think there are similarities with children in recruiting into armed groups and criminal gangs. And I think the three pillars work, you know, prevention, deterrence, and reintegration work for criminal gangs. But I think I would be overstepping my knowledge to in any way advise you on criminal gangs, because I'm not specialty in that. I just know how it sometimes in Africa, in Colombia, where groups of paramilitaries have been demobilized, and now they've become criminal gangs, you know. And then Colombia says they're not armed groups, they're criminal gangs, so let us deal with them as criminal gangs. So there's this blurring of lines also occurring between political gangs and criminal gangs, and then politicians using criminal gangs, and all kinds of things happening. So I think it's really important that we address this issue. And also especially focus on the reintegration, because I think to some extent there has been now a military kind of response to these criminal gangs in Sampa, in Rio, and Mexico, etc. I don't know whether it's needed or not, I don't know enough, but at least the reintegration program should be strong for the people that you save from those gangs. She may lose her voice by then.
In regard to the diamond mines, are children kidnapped and enslaved to work in the diamond mines? And also, do you by chance have any info on what the evangelist Pat Roberts, his dealings with Charles Taylor in regards to the diamond mine he owned at some point? Maybe in the West.
I don't know who Pat Roberts, I'm sorry, am I?
That's okay.
Ignorant?
In this country, he's a well-known evangelist.
Oh, I see.
And he owned a diamond mine.
Oh, no, I don't know about that, but I will say the diamond, you know, as some of the social scientists have pointed out, you know, we say so much about this child soldiers, but basically what you found in Sierra Leone at that time where the children were being exploited, either as soldiers, or they would be abducted and recruited into the diamond mines, or as child workers, or abducted and made to do domestic work. So basically, it was just a period where all the structures broke down and children were being abused for different aspects, soldiering, as well as working in diamond fields. You've seen the movie Blood Diamond, which is actually quite accurate about at least the situation on the ground and what it looked like, these children, you know, the RUF in the diamond fields. But I think the diamond industry has also come a long way. They've now with the certification process and things to deal with this issue.